Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Afterword Podcast. My name is Dave Tisch. For those of you who have been following us, this is the final week to our wonderfully made sermon series. And for the past 5 weeks, we have delved into all sorts of topics that are deeply personal and very important. Things like body, gender, sexuality. I was really careful to use the word personal because I think a lot of people would use the word private. And I'm not sure if that's true. One of the more controversial ideas that Christians hold is that somehow we're all related, that somehow what I do affects you and what you do affects me, that we're all interrelated in this web of mutuality. I think about the famous preacher Martin Luther King, who talked about how we're all interconnected.
Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly for some strange reason. I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be.
As the famous poet John Donne once said, no man is an island unto himself, but each is a part of the continent. And at the end of that famous poem, John Donne says, so do not ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. We're somehow interconnected. This is controversial, I know. And again, this is not about getting all up in somebody else's business or being busybodies. The modern mantra says, like, this is none of your business. This is invasive. I have a right to do exactly as I want, exactly how I see fit. And don't you dare challenge me. In the words of the famous rap group Salt and Peppa,
so don't.
I get that. I do. And I understand invasiveness. I understand when people are cruel. But in this past week, Jay challenged us to be people of both grace and truth, to be people who lovingly confront one another, people who are in such deep community that we understand that what we do affects one another, that we understand that our actions, how we choose to live, can have tremendous impact on the people around us. I mean, it's just true. We think that we're just insular, that nothing we do matters, that nothing we do impacts other people, but that's just not true. I mean, our moods affect other people. The way we choose to live affects other people. Our words affect other people. I had a buddy who just came back from a plane trip, and he said that the woman next to him took off her shoes and began clipping her toenails on the plane. Like, look, I just got to say it, man. Your behavior affects other people more than just you. He said that one of her toenail clippings actually flew up and flew into his cup of Diet Coke. That's just gross. It's just gross. I don't know what else to say. And now, some of you know I'm a bit of a sports fan, so I'm going to use an example from the sports world that I think is really powerful. In the 2020 NFL draft, the Las Vegas Raiders drafted a wide receiver from the University of Alabama. He had just won the national title the year before. His name was Henry Ruggs III. He not only ran the fastest 40-yard dash of the combine at 4.27 seconds, he also had the biggest vertical jump at 42 inches. Incredible prospect, incredible athlete. And they drafted him first because of his field-tilting speed. Well, on November 2nd, 2021, Ruggs was at a bar. He was drinking. He had had way too much to drink, and he was driving home late at night, and he was going 156 miles an hour and slammed into a 23-year-old woman and killed her. And he was charged with driving under the influence. He was charged with, reckless driving. He was charged with manslaughter. The woman died, and he's in jail now, serving a prison term. He had a blood alcohol content of 0.161, which is more than twice the legal limit in Nevada. And it's just a tragic case. And in the aftermath of that, his college coach, Nick Saban, gave this incredible press conference. It was like a speech to his team about what it means to be a leader. But even more, I love what he says. It's actually not even about leadership. It's about being a good friend. And you can actually hear his anger and his frustration that no one stood up.
More than ever before, to influence the other players on the team, because people are more apprehensive about being leaders than they've ever been before, because they're worried about what everybody thinks. The greatest example is You ask one of your players. You got to get up in front of 1,000 people and give a speech. You're going to be nervous and anxious. He's going to say, hell yeah. Why is that? Because you're afraid of what everybody out there thinks of you. Well, if there was a player in Las Vegas who was drinking at 3 o'clock in the morning with his buddies and his girlfriend, and somebody would have taken his keys away, probably would have pissed him off. Probably would have made him mad. Probably wouldn't have thought very much of you for doing that. But would he be better off now? Or is he better off where he was going 156 miles an hour and running the ass into somebody and killing them? And he's in jail and he doesn't have a career anymore. And he's a good kid and he never had one problem on our team in Alabama. So what kind of friend were you? What kind of leader were you when you allowed the guy to do it? But nobody wants to do that because they're afraid of what somebody's going to think of them.
I think what Saban is trying to say here is actually we belong more to each other than we'd like to admit. And as a community, I've watched us the past couple weeks really take ownership of that to try to love each other well and try to seek truth together well. I'm so proud of this. It's been an incredible experience. I've had so many amazing conversations, tough conversations, hard conversations, challenging conversations, but conversations that were based in grace and in truth. This is the way of Jesus. So this week we're going to talk about that. I've got Jay Kim here. There's some questions from folks on staff and from you guys, practical ways to live out this mantra of grace and truth, to be like Jesus in our daily life, some complexities that we're trying to navigate that are really challenging in today's world. So Jay Kim's here. We're going to talk about that. We're going to dive into what it means to be people of both grace and truth, just like Jesus. So let's dive right in.
Let's do it.
All right. Well, welcome to the Afterword, everybody. Here, final week, wonderfully made. Final week. Jay, how you doing, man?
I'm good. Yeah, it's been quite the journey.
I wanted to ask you. It's been 5 weeks. We've done this now for. It feels like a long time because each week has had so much in it. You know, I want to know what as we conclude this series. First of all, some surprising or cool things that you saw happen and. Just kind of what you learned from this sermon, because it does feel like it did take a lot of prep, a lot of organization, and you know, I think some people were like, "Man, I don't know how this is going to go. This is touchy stuff, right?" So, what did you see as we kind of approached the end of the series?
I mean, lots of things. One, it was hard work, heavy lifting for our teachers. And emotionally and otherwise theologically heavy lifting for our church. So I'm really, you know, one of the things, it's something I knew about our church, but it's been sort of reinforced. You know, I'm really grateful for a congregation that desires to get into the hard stuff,
yeah.
You know, real hungry for it. I said it in the teaching on Sunday toward the end, but you know, the teaching was about grace and truth, and it was so cool to watch so many of our folks embody that, or at least try to embody that. My email inbox is full, more full than it usually is, and I knew that would happen, but I didn't know the nature of interactions. Like, I didn't have a good read on, I was ready for anything. I was ready for anger and vitriol and whatever. I was hoping that wouldn't happen. I was very hopeful, knowing our people, and that played out. You know, people extended so much grace, but also had the courage to seek truth through confusion and complexity. And even though clarity was the goal, you know, we're not perfect, so there were moments that felt unclear to some people, but they were honest about it in as loving and kind of a way as possible. So it was really beautiful, you know, and I'm grateful we went on the journey. Clearly not everyone agrees on all sides, but agreement isn't necessarily the primary goal. You know, clarity and compassion were the goals. And it's not just the goal of like our teachers and our leadership. It was the goal for us as a community to become a community of Jesus followers who could extend both clarity and compassion as expressions of love. And I watched our people do that. So I'm really grateful for it. Yeah.
One of the things that was most stark to me is I didn't expect this. Of course, like you, now that I look back on it, it was kind of a foolish expectation. But, you know, these conversations are so contentious online, filled with fire, you know? I kind of expected a little of that. I got none of it. The relational connection, I mean, and not that they weren't easy conversations, but not people really leaned into the trust in the relationships around the table in their life groups. We had some real hard convos. A lot of people were like, I don't get this. Even my wife at one point was like, I don't understand anything about this. Let's talk about this. And, you know, we talked for 2 hours on a point that one of the speakers, I think it was you, brought up just to like get our minds around it. But there was no contentiousness. I didn't feel any of that. And that just showed me, I guess, you know, even in your book, your most recent book, Listen, Speak, it just shows you the embodied reality of these conversations is so critical. And that the online is not the place for this. The social media places are just not, it's just not the place. And so that was really encouraging. I mean, obviously I knew that, but like to see it in real time, I thought was really cool.
Me too. Yeah. Really encouraged. Glad we did it. You know, I think there's probably more conversations to come.
Totally.
It's such a pertinent, important conversation.
Well, so, you say this all the time, first word, not the last. It's like, do you view it a little bit like throwing or like kicking a hornet's nest or throwing a grenade into a, like, how do you view these first, or just like the first, you know, like almost like a bicycle race, like the leader kind of breaks, you know, the kind of wind and that breaks wind. That sounds immature, but you know what I mean? You know, the kind of cyclist, how do you view these kinds of, cause it really does stir up things and people begin to study and it creates tension and they start having convos and start digging into scripture.
Yeah. You know, last night, and this is not the first time I've done this throughout the series, it's not going to be the last. I've got meetings even today with folks in our church who reached out and said, I've got more questions. Last night, I sat with one of our life groups here, you know, and it's a big life group. There were probably, 18, 20 adults in the room. And
wow.
They just had a series of questions. And in their group, it was so cool to see, in their group, many of the questions had bubbled up to the surface because there wasn't, and there still isn't necessarily total, complete, clean theological alignment on the various positions. So they had questions and we were talking last night, but it was so cool. Like, it was a really beautiful time. I sat with them for almost 2 hours and, you know, we just dug into it. And I got an email this morning, just, you know, from one of the leaders of the group reflecting back on the time. And essentially what he said was, man, that was so good. And what he didn't mean is we resolved all the issues and now we're in perfect agreement on everything. They're not. But the takeaway, and he said unanimously from the entire group after I left, they were like, man, this was so good. And it wasn't like Jay was so good. It was the fact that we belong to a community where we can have these conversations that are so hard, so real and pertinent to our actual lives. Like, this conversation wasn't just like, oh, what does this Greek word mean or whatever? It was like, hey, my cousin is transgender, or my neighbor's gay son. We were invited to the wedding. What do we do? You know, it was like that kind of stuff. And there was so much love and empathy, even in the midst of, you know, disagreement and divergences theologically, that it was really beautiful to see. And I know that's not unfolding as beautifully everywhere, you know, for everybody, but generally speaking, the sense I get is that that's the sort of Jesus community we are. And it's not the first word. It is the first word. It's not the last word, but I think, you know, the first word is typically a sermon, but the last word always has to be in community and watching our people do that. It's been really, really cool.
I did have a question. It's pretty interesting. Some folks were writing me. And so as I was preparing for this, the final week of The Wonderfully Made, I actually have some questions from some are from staff, some are from other people in small groups, because I knew that, you know, we were going to be doing this. But I wanted to talk a little bit about grace and truth, because that was the centerpiece of your message. And it's a tough one, mainly because I think people, somebody wrote, I think this is such a tough topic because I'm not the Holy Spirit, so I don't do it perfectly. And sometimes I accidentally make people feel uncomfortable or judged or misunderstood, and that's the opposite of love, and I don't want to do that. So I think that there is some fear that people are, you know, don't want to enter into these conversations. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that was that this is a very hard question. I've got a good friend in our church, and they have a college age daughter, and the college age daughter kind of attends rather grudgingly, you know, church services, and for the wonderfully made is just like, I'm out. This church is biased. I don't want to have any more conversations, and just refuse to come. And it was the cutting off of the conversation, I think, that deeply hurt, you know, my friend. Yeah. I just wondered if you have any advice for that, because like you said, as long as we're in conversation and talking and maintaining those bonds of like relational connection and like, I'm in this with you, feels like almost anything can happen. But that felt like, where do you go from there? And I think that was a question that somebody had, like, well, I know that this was so important and I want to keep having these convos, but you know, my daughter isn't ready to have those, doesn't want to have those, has kind of removed herself from that process. Do you have any advice for that? And again, I think that's a minority of people, but maybe it's not. I don't know. So do you have any advice on how to approach that? Because that's, how do you have grace and truth if the person's like, I don't want to talk about this. I'm over here. I don't even want to converse, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, we don't control what we don't control. So that's really important, I think. What we do control, though, is that we can do the hard work, and it is hard work. It's not easy. But we can do the hard work of clarity and compassion, grace and truth. They're all sort of, in a weird way, synonymous. You know, it's that's why it's hard. You are taking what culture would tell us are two sort of opposing forces and trying to embody both. You know, one of the things we say on our staff is, at a staff level with our pastors, is like, our desire is to be theologically conservative and pastorally liberal, which feels like, how does that even make sense? You know, but, and that's why it's challenging. It kind of doesn't make sense culturally speaking, but you see Jesus do it all the time.
Right.
And so that's why we talked and explored the story this past Sunday about Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well. It's like all grace. I mean, he, you know, breaks through boundary lines that people, especially Jewish rabbis, should not have crossed, but he crosses those boundary lines. He talks to a Samaritan. He talks to a Samaritan woman. He talks to a Samaritan woman who is living with a man, sleeping with a man that is not her husband. I mean, these are all of these. It's like three strikes, you're out kind of thing, but Jesus does it. But he doesn't just extend grace. Alongside grace, he extends truth. He confronts her condition. He names it. He gets all up in her business. He's like, bring me come with your husband. She's like, I don't have a husband. And he's like, you're right. You don't. You've had a bunch of husbands, and the man you're sleeping with right now is not your husband. I mean, that is confrontation to the core, you know?
Yeah.
But couched in grace. And they gather at this well, you know, and we talked about it on Sunday, but many scholars think that that's very intentional storytelling. You know, wells throughout the scriptures are where significant betrothal scenes take place. And Jesus is enacting a sort of marriage of very unlikely people. He doesn't literally marry the Samaritan woman, but what he is saying is that if I, Christ, the Messiah, am the groom, and my people, the church, are the bride, then this woman can belong.
Right.
You know, she can be the bride of Christ.
He's pursuing her in for unity, yeah, in spirit and truth. In order to
do that, this person is going to need to embody in their life what it means to be, you know, in union with Christ.
Yeah.
And that significant life change. So that's the hard work we're called to do. I would say very practically, you know, especially if it's a child, man, you got to navigate that in a way where, you know, at certain seasons of life, you're going to dance and lean more in one direction or the other. You know, if you lead with truth, then it just becomes a conversation about dogma. And that I've never seen dogma transform or change anybody. Love is what changes and transforms somebody. So, you know, lead with love. Make sure that the person feels heard and seen by you and unconditionally embraced and accepted by you. And that feels weird because culture tells us if you do not affirm everything about my life choices, you do not love me. But what the Bible makes clear is that's actually untrue. You know, there's this dangerous thing in culture about tolerance. It's interesting, you know, culture tells us that the most loving thing you can do is be tolerant. But when you think about your actual life, the people you are least tolerant with are the people you love the most. Like my children, I don't just tolerate everything they do and every decision they make. But I don't tolerate it because of love. I want them to become the sort of people that I think will lead to God's glory and their good. And so I course correct as needed. Now that changes. They're 9 and 5. So, you know, of course I'm they're in a season where obedience is the thing I'm trying to teach them, but even obedience is a mechanism for safety and for thriving. You know, I want them to obey so that they can be safe and so that they can thrive. That'll change when they're 12, 15, 18, 25, of course. But still, you know, I think it's a misunderstanding to believe that the most loving thing we can do is to just simply blindly tolerate everything that a person does. You know, I think we have to work toward the good of the other, even if that means hard confrontation. But it has to begin in love. It has to begin with trust. So
yeah, my wife confronted me on me leaving my socks around the house. And so, yeah, she didn't tolerate it. She's like, I'm done. I'm not going to tolerate this. And I think it was done. No, it wasn't done in love. No, it might have been. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. There's a confrontation of both behavior, attitudes. Those, like if Simon came up and just slugged his sister, you're not going to be like, well, you know, to each his own, you know?
Yeah,
that's good. Hey, I'd love to ask this because I do think that there is an attitude. You just kind of named an attitude. I kind of think it. Maybe you think of it differently. I kind of think of it as privatism. Privatism is just like mind your own business. Don't interfere with other people and the way they choose to live their lives. That's actually the highest value in some ways in our when we elevate the self as the purveyor of truth in the center of the world. And it sounds loving and judgmental, like you said, but often it's relational abdication or even cowardice, you know? I'd love to hear a time when somebody confronted you, and I'll share one before you go, just in the interest of, you know, sharing first. But I know that this has happened, that somebody has been brave enough to actually confront you, and it actually helped you because it came from a place of, I don't want you to stay in this place. You know what I mean? I remember when I was a young Christian in Hawaii, I was at this big party. It was somebody's birthday. And I know this is hard to believe, but I got real loud and real funny. And pretty soon I had like a crowd around me. I was on a roll. This was about as funny as I've been in my, I was hysterical, right? Everyone's dying laughing. And I'm feeling real good about it. I'm the center of attention. I'm the center of the party, right? Everyone's like, man, that was great. Funny stories, et cetera, left and right. And as we're driving home, I didn't have a car at that point. So my mentor, who was like an older guy, he was the head of our church. His name was Pastor Sam. He like looked at me and he goes, like, he said, you know, Dave, if you only make jokes, people are going to think you're a clown. And I think you have more things to say than a clown. And it was like, basically like, why are you always making jokes? Why do you want to be the center of attention? Are you going to use that just to attract attention to yourself? And he's like, I think God's going to use your words to be more than a clown. And it was like, it was like transformative. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I would say that was a confrontation, you know, and it helped, you know. I'm sure you have a story, and that was a story from a long time ago. Some people could say, well, it could have been last week. Have you ever had a similar situation where somebody kind of did that?
Oh my gosh.
That you want to share right now?
Well, I just don't have time to share all of them. I mean, I remember in my early 20s, I'd made an absolute utter mess of my life. And I've talked about this before at church. There was a small group of guys, few years older than me. I was in my early 20s. They were in their late 20s. These dudes were like just passionate, committed followers of Jesus. I would meet with them every Monday night, you know, just to hang out and have a good time. But eventually every Monday night, the conversations would turn, you know, late in the night around 10:30, 11 p.m. The conversations would eventually turn to more serious things. And those were eventually they became almost weekly confrontations. It's like, all right, man, tell us about your week. How did you do in this area of your life? Hey, you committed last week that you were going to make a concerted effort to, you know, sort of fight against this particular addiction or this habit or practice. How's that going? It was all confrontation, but it was all done in love. And it began with love. The first several hours every Monday night were an establishing of the love. We just had a good time. They cared for me, loved me, and
safety. Yeah, safety and care. Right. Totally.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I just even more recently just in, you know, Steve Clifford continues to be my pastor and a mentor and just a wise sage in my life. And people wouldn't know this from watching our public interactions because he's such a cheerleader for me. But confrontation is a regular part of our relationship where he will call out like, hey, when you do X, Y, and Z, here's one thing to consider. It might actually unintentionally create, you know, this, that, or this. So I've come to the point,
man,
where
what a gift.
I have like pretty thick skin. I appreciate it. And, you know, as long as it's established and rooted in love, you realize that, like you just said, it's a gift that people offer, you know, for your good.
I don't think people believe that. I in the modern world, it feels like any criticism is like not just unloving, but like almost like cause to end the friendship.
Or, yeah, well, it's crazy.
Intellectually,
it's hard to believe. So you have to experience it. You have to live in it. And you have to like get to the far side of the pain, the sting of critique and course correction.
Right.
And experience the goodness on the other side to realize, oh my gosh, actually, there is a way in which a loving person can lovingly confront me. And it's actually an expression of love. You have to experience it.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to just know it intellectually because it doesn't sound right.
I did have a question that came in. I'd love your, it said, hey, how do you know when to speak up and when to shut up? Do you have any guidance on this? Is it based on personal relational depth? Is it as simple as listening to the Holy Spirit? What do you have to say about this? Do you have any advice on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to begin with curiosity. I think you have to be curious about what you're hearing and be curious with yourself. Why do you want to say the thing you want to say? So for me, one of the most helpful things has been to notice, you know, our friend Steve Cuss actually has been such a tremendous gift to me in this way. You have to learn the art, and it is an art. You have to learn the art of noticing your body's reactivity. So, typically when somebody says something or someone you care deeply about does something that even if it's true, like, you know, it's working toward their demise and destruction. The first thing your body will do is react. And I don't think that's ever a good place from which to speak. So I think it's important to notice the reactivity and then begin asking the question, why am I reacting this way? And then when they're saying whatever it is they're saying, to ask the question, this is from another friend of ours, Steve Carter, has this fantastic book called The Thing Beneath the Thing. Curiosity is the path we take to excavating the thing beneath the thing beneath the behavior, or the real hurt or pain or loss or grief that is beneath the, you know, vitriolic or whatever, you know, offensive thing that they're saying. There's always a thing beneath the thing. So I think we have to be curious. We have to ask more questions than give answers. Take that path, that journey of curiosity, and then have the courage from there, you know, to not react, but have the courage to respond with grace and with truth, you know, and it does take courage. So, I mean, I could talk about that for hours and hours, but to be succinct, that's what I would say. Let curiosity lead the way about the other person. What is the thing beneath this thing? And ask questions to excavate that. And then be curious about yourself.
So if you rev up inside, you just say, wait, I need to take some time to figure out why I'm revved up. And then speak from a place of clarity later.
Give yourself
a timeout, you know?
Well, I don't know that I would give myself a timeout. The more you practice this, the more quickly it can happen.
Oh, good.
Like it can happen in a matter of, for most of us, if we're not familiar with reactivity, it'll take much more time. You may need to like step away and say, man, I'm so glad we're talking about this. Let me give it some more thought. And can we circle back in a day or two? But you practice it enough. And I know people who can acknowledge it, address it, and work through it in real time in the conversation. So it just really depends kind of where you're at.
That's great. Well, we should probably get going. But man, what a great series. I'm so grateful for our friends at Echo and Menlo and Vintage Faith. Yeah. I'm so grateful for the guest speakers that came in. Throwing heat. So JRB and Nassim, so great. Actually, it's a lot of Portland. Did you plan that? That's a lot of Portland. You imported a lot of Portland. Is it just because you like their coffee? You like their coffee and their theology? Is that what's going on?
Maybe that's what it is.
Well, so we're going to start Philippians, I think, next. Is that next? Yes. Yeah, it's next week. So we're going to be diving back into that. Excited for that. So, well, thanks for your time, Jay. And thanks for these insights. Yeah. Grace and truth, so important. And they're hard to embody. But again, like we see with Jesus, possible to do. So let's grow in that, man. Thanks a ton for all this. And my prayer for all the folks out there is they'll continue to grow in not just this topic of the body and sexuality and gender, but all topics, really, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, man.
Thanks, Dave.
All right. See you soon.
Bye.
All right. Bye. Just want to say thanks to Jay Kim for stopping by, sharing, dropping some wisdom, dropping some real wisdom there. And I'm so grateful for you guys. Join us next week when we dive into our 8-part sermon series on Philippians called This Is Living. I was hoping it would be called You Were Meant to Live for So Much More. Then I could just like play a Switchfoot song. That would be just awesome. But it's called This Is Living, which doesn't tie to a Switchfoot song, but still a good title. So join us for that. We're going to be spending 8 weeks in the book of Philippians and what Paul teaches us about what it means to live. We're so excited about that. So join us for that starting next week. We'll see you soon.